Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Amity.
And I'm Laura. Let's get started.
Okay, we're excited today to jump into Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. Today, we're going to cover chapters 1 through 12, and we're thrilled to be able to include our friend and Jane Austen aficionado, Nan. So let's jump in. Is there anything we want to do to start off? I feel like we did a pretty good introduction of all things Jane Austen last week.
I just want to say that I've had a couple of people tell me they're so excited about us doing this book.
Oh, good.
And then they would get really excited and I say, Nan's going to do it with us. And they're like, that's going to be amazing. So,
yeah. And I want to throw in, last night I was really excited because Ken and I are helping to usher at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. And we're doing that so that we can see the plays for free because you go usher and then you just say, yeah, we'll stay late so that you help like clean up and stuff at the end. And then you can sit and watch the plays and they're really wonderful. So last night it was A Midsummer Night's Dream, which was just probably the best production of A Midsummer Night's Dream that I've ever seen. It was incredible. But they do a green show before, which is very Shakespearean, something that they always did before the plays in Shakespeare's time. They always have them based on some of their main plays that they're doing. And they're doing Emma the Musical this year, which I have never heard before, but I'm excited for it. So it's just this Regency English garden party is what it's called, the whole theme of the green show. So we're kind of watching before our play starts. The whole thing, they just kept quoting Pride and Prejudice. Like it's supposed to be like sort of based on Emma, but throughout it all, they're like quoting Pride and Prejudice. I was like, oh, there it is. That was Darcy. That was Jane.
That's kind of what I'm excited about, like doing this and reading all of her works eventually, like, and getting to know them. I'll know what people are talking about, what characters are in which books. And like, when you hear quotes, you'll know, oh, that's Jane Austen or whatever. Yeah. I was talking to one of our friend, Kirsten, and I asked if she wanted to read my book because we were at a thing and she was bored. She just knows everything about Jane Austen. I just like,
oh, cool.
She's like 16. It's great. Anyways, I'm excited to join that club.
Okay. So jumping into chapter one, so I'll go through and summarize and we can pick out what we want to talk about. And I found it was harder than I thought it would be to summarize because you want to talk about everything because everything that she says in here is so, it's so good. It's so clever. It's so witty. And you're like, if I leave anything out, you're kind of like losing a part of the book. So anyway, we'll talk about it. Okay. As we kind of talked about last week, it starts out in chapter one with probably one of the best lines. It's so good. She says, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." And she goes on to talk about how, like, when he moves into a neighborhood, all the families sort of feel like they have this ownership, this claim on him. They're like, oh, you're here for my daughter, you know? So we open with Mrs. Bennet informing Mr. Bennet that Netherfield Park has been rented out to a young man from the north of England who has a large fortune. His name is Bingley, and of course he is single because she wouldn't even be bringing it up probably if he weren't single. And she states that this is a fine thing for their girls. So Mr. Bennet, he loves teasing Mrs. Bennet and just keep sort of poking at her. Well, why? Why is this even a good thing? He won't even answer when she says something. He just keeps acting like he has no idea what she's even referring to, but states that she wants him to visit Mr. Bingley in hopes that he can like ingratiate himself and his family on behalf of their girls so that this wealthy young man will fall in love with one of their girls. And he's so funny. He's like, you and the girls can go visit Mr. Bingley. I think he says in here something about how, maybe it's not right here that he says it. Maybe it's later on when he's like, well, maybe he'll like you because you're the most handsome one of the bunch or something. Anyway, it's really funny. But he's like, why don't you and the girls go visit Bingley and I'll send a letter and I'll tell him that he can marry any of my daughters that he chooses. And he says, but I'll probably throw in an extra line for Lizzie because I really like her. And Mrs. Bennet is like, well, but she's not nearly as handsome as Jane. She's not nearly as pleasant as Lydia. He says, well, Lizzie's kind of his favorite because she's very quick and witty and intelligent. Mrs. Bennet is totally distraught with Mr. Bennet. He is adamant with her that he will not go and visit Mr. Bingley. But as it turns out, he's one of the first to visit him. So that entire back and forth is really him like trying to sort of drive her crazy, which he knows works after so many years of marriage and the constant companionship of her nerves. So he is one of the first to go and visit Mr. Bingley, but he doesn't share that with his wife. So we catch the family in this conversation, and Mrs. Bennet is just so disgusted with Mr. Bennet because he won't go and visit Mr. Bingley. And she's like, no, we're never going to meet him because nobody will introduce us to him. And everyone in their neighborhood, everyone in their acquaintance is just the worst because she's sure they would never introduce her family to Bingley. And Mr. Bennet is like, well, probably you're going to be the first one to be able to introduce him to them. She's like, how could that be? And anyway, it's just this whole back and forth and very, very dramatic. And finally, by the end, Mrs. Bennet is like, I am sick of Mr. Bingley. And of course, that's when Mr. Bennet is able to seize his moment and say, well, that's too bad because I went and visited him. And so then, of course, Mrs. Bennet is all the world is green and glorious and wonderful and everyone is beautiful and perfect and all is well and right. I did want to really quickly note, and then you ladies jump in with the things that you want to talk about. Authors always approach this very differently, but Jane Austen does not give us really any outright introduction to the Bennet family. It's just like, here they are, right into conversation, and we're able to sort of draw conclusions as we go along, which I love. It's like she's expecting her readers to have some intelligence and to be engaged enough in her writing. And her writing, of course, is so wonderful that by the end, you have this amazing sketch of what her characters are. And then by the end of chapter two, we understand they do have five daughters, and she has finally named all of them. And so they are Jane, Lizzie, Mary, Kitty, and Lydia.
That is one thing that I was going to concur with Amity on, is Austen does this brilliant characterization, and just, it's like 5 pages, these two chapters are. It's very short, and you have a very thorough picture of exactly who these characters are, particularly Mr. and Mrs. Bennet. And I think Mrs. Bennet is a little bit naturally obtuse, like she misses a lot of stuff, and it points to her as she's very practical in her sense of like trying to get her daughters wed, but she's not witty. She misses stuff. Their dad is purposely obtuse, and it's with the effort of kind of goading their mom because he thinks it's funny. It is funny. And you can imagine that there would be lots of happy arguments between these two over the years, and not least of which over whether or not he would visit Mr. Bingley. And so I think after the two chapters, you get this sense of like, Mrs. Bennet desperately trying to do the right thing for her girls, and Mr. Bennet also wanting to do the right thing for his girls. He's just not so panicked about it as their mom is. Then you also start to get a little bit of character sketch of the girls, of which ones are sensible, which ones are less so, which ones relate more to their mom, which relate more to their dad. Kind of a quick note about names too. You'll see names. Mr. and Mrs. Bennet are always Mr. and Mrs. Bennet. We do not know their first names throughout the course of the book. Jane is the oldest. She also sometimes goes by Miss Bennet when they're introduced. The oldest daughter would be introduced by just her surname and Miss. So if you see the phrase Miss Bennet, that is always Jane. And then Elizabeth gets several different names. She's sometimes called Miss Eliza, Miss Lizzie. Lizzie mostly to her family, Elizabeth. So you'll see different names there. The third daughter, Mary, is a whole character study in and of herself. She'll come up more later. The fourth daughter, Catherine, is also called Kitty. So Catherine and Kitty are the same. So if you see the name Catherine pop up, and then Catherine is the name of another character later on. So names are kind of important. And then Lydia, the youngest, interestingly enough, becomes a major character later on in the novel. So just kind of a quick note there about names. But it is pretty amazing that in just like 5 pages, Austen has given us a full rundown of exactly who this family is.
Yes, it's clever things like, you know, you're talking about Mary. So we only get a couple lines about Mary, but just the way that she does it, it's her father directs a question to her and he says, you're a young lady of deep reflection, I know, and read great books and make extracts. And it says, Mary wished to say something sensible, but knew not how. And so you get, she is, she reads a lot. She studies, she's like desperate to try to be somebody and to be significant, but she is intelligent and well-read, but she doesn't have the quick wit of her sister Elizabeth.
It's very funny, if you know, when Mary speaks, she'll make like a speech. She doesn't say very much, but when she talks, it's kind of a speech and nobody responds to her, because I don't think anybody quite knows how to respond when she makes one of these speeches. There's kind of like dead silence afterwards, and then they go on to another topic. It happens almost every time Mary talks.
Yeah, it's true. And I underlined one of her speeches that we'll talk about later, and I was like, there's so much like redundancy. She just keeps saying the same thing over and over. Some of it is actually quite profound, but a lot of it is just the same thing over and over.
She changes what she calls them, and I think it's kind of confusing because there's a lot of characters.
There are a lot of characters.
She doesn't bother to explain about names because she was writing for her contemporary audience, and in 1811, people would have just understood that there were formal rules of address for these different characters, and it would not have occurred to her that her audience wouldn't understand the formal rules of address. I don't think in anything in Austen's mind thought, well, 200 years from now, people are going to be reading this and they're going to need more explanation for what's going on here. She was very much writing for a contemporary audience. So,
and then the other thing was just like, I mentioned it last week, but Mr. Bennet is my husband. He'll tease, kind of. I don't know. It's hard to explain. Like, he'll act like I don't understand something or whatever, but he's just totally like egging me on. And then he'll say to me, like, we've been married for 23 years. You don't get me yet. You totally don't know I'm joking. I don't know. It just kind of reminded me of him. He wouldn't give it up, right? He was like, I'm not going to see him. And then he did go see him.
He just enjoys the argument more than anything, and like pushing her buttons and seeing how she's, because I think he probably does get a kick out of it. And I kind of liked your description, Nan. What exactly did you say to sort of these
naturally obtuse, and he's purposely obtuse. Yeah.
And they would have like these just kind of funny arguments over the years, probably.
And I think this line says it best. This is in chapter one. Mr. Bennet, how can you abuse your own children in such a way? You take delight in vexing me. You have no compassion for my poor nerves. Oh, you mistake me, my dear. I have high respect for your nerves. They are my old friends. I've heard you mention them with consideration these last 20 years, at least.
They always come up in conversation.
Yeah, it's like she's totally oblivious to like how she is or what he's doing. Totally oblivious.
She's not very self-aware, and that becomes evident throughout. The other thing that I think is brilliant about Austen, and I've done a little bit of writing on my own, and so this is one thing, like keeping your own characters straight as you write them and work through them and making sure they all have their own voice, so they're distinctive. And one thing that Austen is brilliant at is five daughters is a big undertaking in a book, and they're close in age. And how do you differentiate these girls from one another and give them a place in the novel and all of these things? To an individual, hardly one of these characters ever says anything that feels like it's out of character. Everything they say is perfectly consistent with who Austen is painting them to be. And that's no easy trick. It's brilliant.
Yeah. The fact that really this family, well, throughout the whole book, but since we're just talking about the Bennets right now, you have seven very distinct characters, and they're all just like delightful in their own funny way. So yeah, it's brilliant to be able to come up with that and just keep it so consistent through this entire novel. It's wonderful.
So I've got chapters 3 and 4. So if 1 and 2 were really about the Bennet family, then 3 and 4 are going to be about Darcy and Bingley. You know, I sometimes feel like we're giving away spoilers, but these stories are really, really well known. So Darcy and Bingley are going to be the love interests for the two eldest daughters in the Bennet family. As in like a lot of things, Austen, they first meet at a ball. So one thing we've got to recognize, I talked about this a little bit last week. So Darcy and Bingley are probably, with their money, they're probably in what they would call the ton in England, where they would have like probably run around with the wealthiest families in England, families that were titled, people had places in Parliament, lots of money. So when they are in London, Darcy and Bingley very likely run around with a very elite set of people. Bingley is looking at this house, and they come out to the countryside. And one of the first things that's done is they have this kind of country dance. Now, this country dance they go to would have looked very, very different than a ballroom in England. And we talked about this last week also, where if you're a fan of that Keira Knightley version of Pride and Prejudice, they do a pretty brilliant job of showing what that opening country dance would have looked like. It does look like it's taking place in some kind of a barn, which is probably the only place in the country somebody would have had a large enough place to gather a large number of people. They talk about it being crowded. We've got to remember it's like 1810 or whatever. Like, we have this kind of genteel version, I think, sometimes of the olden days, which is not consistent of what it would have looked like. You've got unwashed bodies. You've got probably people mingling from all classes who were invited to this dance. Enter Bingley's party. So let's look at the five people in Bingley's party. So you have Bingley himself, who's come to rent this house. He has $5,000 a year up to this point. That's about all that we know about Bingley. He brings his friend Darcy with him. And of course, these are last names. And when they refer to men, they oftentimes, they might say Mr. Darcy, but they might just also say Darcy. That's his last name. We know Mr. Bingley's first name is Charles. His sisters call him that sometimes. Mr. Darcy's first name is Fitzwilliam. The only time we see that is when he writes a letter at one point and signs it with his full name. But otherwise, nobody calls him that. He's always Darcy. Anyway, they come together, and then Mr. Bingley's two sisters come with them as well. So Mr. Bingley's oldest sister is known as Mrs. Hurst because she is married and her husband is there too. And he's the most non-character of our principals. He's just sort of a space filler. Then Caroline Bingley is the younger of the two sisters, and she is also with them in the party. And she definitely, we're going to find out pretty quickly, she's got her hooks in Darcy. She's hoping that she will get to marry him because he has $10,000 a year. And that's about all we know about Darcy at this point too. So they come to the country dance. Mr. Bingley immediately begins dancing with everybody. Mr. Darcy and the rest of the party remain quite aloof from everybody else. Elizabeth, it says that there's not enough gentlemen at the dance, so she has to sit out some of the dances, which none of the ladies ever liked. And then you've got Mr. Darcy, who's kind of refusing to dance. This is very ill-mannered of him to not dance when there's so many ladies who need a partner. And then she overhears a conversation between him and Bingley, which sets these two on a course for the whole book. And this is part of the reason why this book was originally called First Impressions, is that Elizabeth's first impression of Darcy is terrible. And not only does he imply that he hates dancing because he doesn't know anybody, but he doesn't even think there's any attractive women there, except for Jane, who Mr. Bingley has already danced a couple of times with. Bingley enthusiastically says all these wonderful things about Jane, but then he says, well, there's one of her sisters sitting over there, and she is uncommonly pretty. You should ask her to dance. And Darcy looks at Elizabeth very disdainfully, even long enough to catch her eye. It almost implies that he's speaking loudly enough because he wants her to hear. And he says, she's tolerable, but not handsome enough to tempt me. I am in no humor at present to give consequence to young ladies who are slighted by other men. Because she's sitting out and not dancing, why would I want to dance with her? Now, Elizabeth thankfully has quite a sense of humor, but you get the impression that before the night's over, she's certainly told her friends, Mr. Darcy said, and she's probably told her mother too, because at the very end of chapter 4, her mother indicates that she knows that Darcy didn't ask her to dance and refers to him as a disagreeable, horrid man, not at all worth pleasing, despite his $10,000 a year. So then in the next chapter, we're introduced a little bit more to Bingley's sisters. And then it's kind of this aftermath of the ball. So you've got to remember, like, in these genteel societies for these folks, they don't have a ton of things going on necessarily. Most of the work of the household is done by their servants. And so after a night of like merriment like this, the girls probably slept late, woke up late, and then they spend the whole day discussing the ball and all of its aftermath. And then that's really what chapter 4 looks like, is this discussion of the ball. And yeah, here she's just talking to her family pretty much. And then we get a little bit more background between Darcy and Bingley and their friendship and why they're friends. The only other thing I wanted to say about these chapters is thinking of Jane, who has this very sweet, placid, calm kind of character. It's clear that Jane values marrying for love, but on some level, Jane, who we get less insight into her character because it's told more from Lizzie's point of view, Jane must really, really feel the weight of her family's expectations here. Because if Jane is able to make a good match And Miss Bennett puts this very bluntly later on, that if Jane makes a good match, that puts the girls in the path of other rich men. And so they very much are hoping, their hopes are really resting on Jane. Jane is beautiful. Jane is kind. Jane is everything that a gentlewoman should be. And they very much need Jane to make a good match if the rest of these girls are going to have a chance.
Does she have to get matched before the rest of them can? Is that one of the rules?
Not necessarily. Later on, Elizabeth has a conversation with an older woman who very much is into the rules of the town and society and everything. And she is shocked to find out that basically all the girls are out at the same time. It seems like the older one should be out and get married, and then the next one comes out. But with five daughters so close in age, and really Miss Bennett's kind of indifference to regulating their behavior a little bit better, probably as we learn more about, especially Lydia's personality, Lydia is the type to throw a tantrum when the older sisters get to go to balls. In my mind, that's maybe what happened. And then Miss Bennett just gave up. So all the girls are kind of out at the same time. And truthfully, Jane and Elizabeth are a little bit on the older side for this marriage mark. Girls usually came out in their late teens. 17, 18 was pretty normal for girls to be coming out in London. And we know that both Jane and Lizzie are in their early 20s. So they are a little bit on the old side. And Jane herself may be feeling anxious about this. We don't get a whole lot of insight into that. But in this time and in this culture, for Jane to be what? She's 21, 22 years old. That would be late to be married. And she's likely feeling the panic. And they've never had a proper season in London. So there's less.
There's one point where they talk about their friend Charlotte, who is 27. And Miss Bennett has nothing nice to say about her. And it's like, you know, basically she's past her prime because she's 27 and unmarried, which is so, I don't know. It's so sad.
Well, and their own sphere is pretty limited as well, because even though they've got like the village of Meryton that they're close to, and even though they're not really inheriting much property, they're still kind of this like landed gentry class. And they would have been expected to at least marry another young person of their same class. There's not that many families, and the Bennets have five daughters, and the Lucases seem to have a bunch of daughters too. So there's probably just not a lot of opportunity for them, especially with their dad being reluctant to go to London. He doesn't like London. He says that pretty bluntly later on. And so they've never been. And so this idea that they're going to find somebody of their class locally in their neighborhood, you know, this is why all of these marriage-minded mamas like glom on to Mr. Bingley so much when he shows up. He would have felt it everywhere he went in this town, people throwing their daughters at him.
Yeah. And I do have to say, it's interesting because, you know, when Mr. Bingley's party comes into the dance, everybody is immediately like, oh, there's Mr. Bingley. But then, oh, there's his friend. And he drew attention immediately because he was tall. He was very handsome. And immediately it circulated that he was like worth double what Mr. Bingley was. And so just immediately like, oh, he's amazing. But then his manners and the way he treated everybody, it just, everybody drew away pretty quickly. They're like, it doesn't matter how handsome or how wealthy he is. He's so rude. He's so demeaning. And just, it was like, never mind. It says his character was decided. He was the proudest, most disagreeable man in the world. And everybody hoped that he would never come there again. So I had to admire that just a little bit. Like, okay, at least they had some self-respect to not just like throw their daughters at him just because he was someone wealthy. It was like, he was so rude. Never mind.
There's some indication it's not just in the country where he behaves this way, because right at the end of chapter four, it kind of juxtaposes Bingley and Darcy with each other.
Yes.
And it says, in that respect, his friend had the great advantage. Bingley was sure of being liked wherever he appeared. Darcy was continually giving offense.
I mean, he's sort of practiced at it, isn't he? I mean, Bingley's practiced at being very pleasant and going to assume the best. And right underneath that, it gives a little more. It says, Bingley had never met with more pleasant people or prettier girls in his life. This is sort of his take on the country dance. Everybody had been most kind and attentive to him. There had been no formality, no stiffness. He had soon felt acquainted with all the room. And Darcy, on the contrary, had seen a collection of people in whom there was little beauty and no fashion, for none of whom he had felt the smallest interest, and from none received either attention or pleasure. And I love that because it really, it gives you this whole picture of like it's all about your perspective and your attitude and what you're putting into a situation. And Bingley was determined to see the best, and he did. He saw beautiful, kind, wonderful people, despite their maybe less than perfect circumstances. And Darcy was like, ew, no, they're not even attractive. He was just determined to not see them as attractive, probably just mostly because they didn't have the finest clothes or the nicest spaces. And yeah, so that first impressions title, it really would have worked all the way around for sure.
I also feel like I could sit and listen to you guys talk forever. You're going to notice, I mean, I don't have a perspective of the end of the book, right? So as I'm talking, I'm not going to be able to do what they do and say like, oh, this is going to come up later or whatever, because I have no clue. I only know what the first happens in the first 12 chapters. But so chapter 5 and 6. So the next morning, the Bennets walk over to discuss the fall with their neighbors, the Lucases. So Charlotte is the Lucas's oldest daughter, and she's also a good friend of Elizabeth Bennet. So everyone agrees that Mr. Bingley really liked Jane Bennet. Then the conversation turns to Mr. Darcy. And nobody was impressed with Mr. Darcy's personality, like we just discussed. So he had insulted Elizabeth. He wouldn't really talk to anybody. People had like tried to engage in conversation and he was mute. But Charlotte says that he should be forgiven because of his status, his money. Elizabeth says, well, I could easily forgive his pride if he hadn't have insulted me. I mean, I can't even imagine like somebody saying out loud, like, well, she's not that pretty. I mean, does that happen? No, it shouldn't.
Anyway. I think that it does. But no, it shouldn't happen.
Well, I would think it probably did before we were like 12, but I don't know. It's just awful. I would be like, yeah, I'm not interested in you ever.
Ever.
And when he says that line, like, I'm not interested in giving consequence to young ladies who've been slighted by other men, these wealthy these wealthy men knew that, like, if they danced with a girl, it could make her season, right? Like, if Mr. Darcy was to dance with Elizabeth, every man in the room would have wanted to dance with her. So it wasn't just that he was dancing with her, he's giving consequence to her. Mm-hmm. He's making her seem more important than she is. So they were careful about who they showed attention to because of the gossip. It still doesn't excuse the fact that it seems pretty clear that he meant for her to overhear him.
Yeah. He says, I could easily forgive his pride if he had not mortified mine. So then Mary Bennet, which I was super confused at this point with who the daughters were, whatever. So Mary Bennet lectures everyone about human nature. I love this and I want to talk about it later. That pride is common, it's human nature, but vanity and pride are different, and you can be proud without being vain. And then she says, pride relates more to our opinion of ourselves and vanity to what we would have others think of us. So when I looked up Mary, and then Nan kind of talked about it a little bit, that she's the middle daughter and she likes books like her father, but she is also self-important, moralistic, and boring. Like what you were saying is that she talks and then nobody responds. There are people like that in the world where they talk and you just are like, okay.
I don't know what to say to that.
Move on.
Yeah.
And I love this because I'm a pianist. She plays the piano mechanically well, but without feeling, and for much longer than anybody would like to listen. Not only does she talk longer than anybody wants to listen, her piano playing is awful too. Awful boring, I guess. So
I think there's a line about Mary at one point that says she had neither genius nor taste.
Yeah.
In how she played the piano.
Poor thing. Like, I just feel sad for Mary. She's like trying so hard to know.
Well, she's the middle child. She's probably just desperately trying to find a place in this family, and she's failed because she's not interesting. She's boring. So the Bingley sisters. Elizabeth realizes that they are only nice to Jane because their brother likes her. Elizabeth can also see that Jane is starting to like Mr. Bingley. She's starting to fall for him. And so she mentions that to Charlotte. And Charlotte warns her that if she doesn't show affection, then she's going to lose him. And Elizabeth thinks that's too mechanical, too businesslike. And she also thinks Jane can't possibly know if she likes him. They just haven't spent enough time together. And then I love this, and we'll talk about this later too. Charlotte says that happiness in marriage happens only by chance. I love these like wisdom, you know, or they can be false or whatever, but like these things that they throw out about relationships. It's like, is that true? Is it not true? So Darcy is now spending more time with Elizabeth, and that's when he begins to notice her. At one of the parties, Sir William Lucas tries to set them up to dance, but Elizabeth says no. Later, Mr. Darcy tells Caroline that Elizabeth has basically caught his eye, which is going to cause some problems soon, I believe, that Caroline is not going to like that. But then she's also relieved that he doesn't seem interested in marrying her. He's like, she's caught my eye, but I'm not really interested in pursuing this because of her lower social status. I love Caroline reminding him of all the reasons why he might not want to be involved with Elizabeth. Like, remember her mother-in-law? Or your mother-in-law, she's probably going to come to your house and, you know, be very involved. So what do you think? Happiness in marriage only happens by chance? I think it might a little bit.
I think it's hard work.
It is hard work. And so I guess the chance comes in where it's like, well, are the two parties willing to put in the work?
Yeah, but I feel like you don't know that in the beginning, especially kind of in our culture. We tend to get married kind of quickly. That's my thought, is I do think it takes work. And if both people want to work on it and be in the marriage, you can make it work and you can have happiness. But I just think it's kind of a chance.
Well, I do think too, writing from this time period in the early 1800s, love matches were just starting to be a thing. So prior to that time, marriage was largely a business arrangement. And in a lot of ways, it still is, right? We talked about this last week where these girls are kind of auctioned off to the highest bidder in a lot of ways. Like, that's what the marriage mart sort of looked like. But this idea that like Elizabeth or Jane are holding out for a love match is a very revolutionary idea in Austen's time. And our modern view of marriage is like, two loving individuals working together to build a family and a home. This is not traditionally, I think it's funny when we talk about traditional marriage. Well, I'm glad we don't have traditional marriage, honestly. Like, traditional marriage really until like early mid 1800s and even way past that time for most people was largely a business arrangement. So
I mean, there's a lot of business arranging still happening in different parts of the world. It is absolutely still happening. Yeah.
To live in a time when women have choices, first of all, about whether or not to get married, and then we have choices about whom we marry, I think we leave less up to chance. I do think you're right. You don't know how people are going to change and grow, and you don't know if you're going to change and grow together, right? You can't know that going in. But I think Charlotte's viewpoint is more like, doesn't matter if you're happy, you're just trying to secure a partner. And I think that's part of what she's trying to talk to Elizabeth about. And maybe, you know, she's 28 or 27 and not married. Maybe she's had an experience of her own. Maybe she lost a beau somewhere along the way because she didn't let him know of her affection soon enough. And so for her, it's like she needs to secure him now rather than later. She's like, well, they hardly know each other. She's like, it doesn't matter. It's all about getting married. Whether or not they're happy, that's secondary to whether or not she's actually able to get married. And so Charlotte's perspective, being 5 or 6 years older than the Bennet girls, is different. And she is a little more jaded and a little more hard-headed about her view of what marriage is or isn't. We'll find out later in the book, in Charlotte's own experience, that you can find ways to make your own happiness too, even when the chance you take is not necessarily the best choice. Charlotte is just eminently practical here. And I think in Charlotte's mind, she's like, I wouldn't even care if I didn't like him, as long as I had some security.
I did want to say too, that also this part where she talks about, she says in 9 cases out of 10, a woman had better show more affection than she feels. Bingley likes your sister undoubtedly, but he may never do more than like her if she does not help him on. And it does go back to that, like, secure him. But it's also a little bit of foreshadowing for something that's going to happen later in the book, because in Darcy's eyes, Jane does not do that. She doesn't show as much affection. And so he thinks that she doesn't like Bingley and that she's just sort of being nice.
Well, and I think too, I remember reading this book like as a teenager and just seeing yourself in different ways in different characters. Because one of the things was hard for me about some of my friends is how hard they would like flirt and work to meet boys or be with boys, even sometimes boys I didn't really like, but it was just what they did and who they were. I was a little bit later to the marriage mart myself. Like, I didn't really date until like I was in my early 20s and not with any kind of regularity, and always felt like awkward and strange. And I just remember always thinking like, well, shouldn't I just be working on myself? And I should be less concerned about like making sure I know how to secure somebody and how to catch their eye. And I feel like these characters in these kinds of books, like Lizzie was enormously helpful to me in that way, is that Lizzie's just happy to be herself and she's not out seeking to like flirt or catch somebody. It kind of happens by accident because she is just herself. And that's the thing you start to see with Mr. Darcy, is he sees the way that she's like humorous and clever and the way her eyes light up when she's laughing with her friends. And he is just, they use the word bewitch a few times. He kind of falls under her spell without her really trying to secure. Yes. She's just absolutely being herself. And even though at first he realizes, well, she's not conventionally beautiful, but when she's here laughing and making merry with her friends, or she's telling jokes or witticisms, he kind of can't help, but he does. He falls under her spell a little bit, even from like their very second meeting, because he sees her being her genuine self.
Just completely authentic. Yeah, there's no pretension. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in 7 and 8.
I think that's the key to catching somebody, is kind of being yourself. And the girls that are like super flirty, and there's no mystery to them.
Well, and also they tend to sort of change themselves to conform to what they think a man wants, which is really kind of sad. And instead of
your value is only to be a decoration.
Right.
And then, you know, think of that like a matter of chance. Well, what's going to help start a relationship is if you have similar interests or things in common. And that's not going to happen without you being yourself. You won't know if the guy likes you because of the way that you have flirted with him or because of who you are.
Right.
The only other line I wanted to point out before we move on, because I think it's so funny, is they're trying to convince Mr. Darcy to dance. Mr. Lucas has like, he was like knighted by the king or something like that. Mm-hmm. So he's Sir Lucas now. Lucas has been, for whatever reason, Lucas has been conferred a title, and it makes him kind of self-important. What charming amusement this is for young people, Mr. Darcy. Nothing like dancing at all. I consider it as one of the first refinements of polished society. Yeah. And Mr. Darcy's savage answer is so good. Certainly, sir. It has the advantage also of being in vogue among the less polished societies of the world. Every savage can dance. So he's like, that argument is not going to work on me. Every culture dances. You're not going to convince me to dance because it's what polished people do.
And like act like it's what I have to do if I'm going to show that I'm a polished person. In his way, he's also being himself. He's not going to like be pushed around at all. For better or worse, he's not going to be pushed around. He's just going to be himself.
And in his own pride, he sets down Mr. Lucas's pride also, because Sir William Lucas can be kind of pompous and prideful sometimes. And Darcy is like trying to outpride him, almost like, well, my pride's better than yours. Come for more money or whatever.
So again, I love how we get these little descriptions, little glimpses into everybody's situation, whether it's the location of the town or family situations or whatever. So in chapter 7, we find out that Mr. Bennett, he has about £2,000 per year. And so that is like less than half of like Mr. Bingley's, for example. The major problem for his family and why his wife is like kind of so desperate to see her daughters married well is because his heir is this distant male relation that we'll be introduced to later. So if he passes away suddenly, and you know, like they've been married for 23 years, I don't know, he's probably like at least mid 40s. If he passes away suddenly, it's not like life expectancy is huge at that point. His daughters are just out of luck, like too bad, you know? And so all of his money would go to a male relation. And then it kind of talks about how they have an aunt and uncle, Mrs. Bennett's sister and brother-in-law, that live in the town of Meryton. And then Mrs. Bennett has a brother who lives in London in Cheapside. And he's done quite well for himself, but apparently Cheapside is not like the most upscale part of London. But it sounds like it is quite expensive to live in London. We also find out a little bit more about their location again. So they live in the village of Longbourn, and their house, the Bennett house, is sort of like the main house in Longbourn. And it's just this little village. But the town is where all the shops are and everything, is the town of Meryton. It's about a mile away. And that's where the military, they've got a division that's staying there. And so Kitty and Lydia are just over the moon about this. So they're frequently traveling into Meryton. It says at least 3 times a week. They love the little shops there. They visit with their Aunt Phillips. And they want to find out everything they can about the officers. So this is just sort of a brief introduction to the fact that the military is there. They are very interested in the officers. This will come into play a lot more later. Mr. Bennett expresses his observation that his girls are very silly. He says this many times, but he specifically in this chapter is talking about Kitty and Lydia. And Mrs. Bennett is like, if you're going to think slightingly of any children, it shouldn't be your own, you know, but he's like, well, sorry, they're just really silly. And I don't think they're very clever. And he's like, this is one thing that we are not going to agree on. So this is kind of a funny little aside in this whole chapter, but
yeah, I love how he says, if my children are silly, I hope to be sensible of it, which I think is wise, right? I think as much as we need to unconditionally love our children, we do them a disservice if we aren't aware of their shortcomings, because we can't really help them if we bury our heads in the sand over problems our children may have.
Well, sometimes I think I may be too hard on my kids because I'm like, I see everything, but we also have our blind spots no matter what. So. Okay, so right then, this message is delivered to the house from Netherfield, and it's for Jane, and it's an invitation to come and dine with Miss Bingley and Mrs. Hurst. And this is so funny because Mrs. Bennett is like, oh, yes, you should go and you should ride the horse because it looks like it's going to rain. Obviously, you know, you should ride the horse. And Jane is like wanting to take the carriage. And Mrs. Bennett is like, no, no, the horses are out. They can't be used. And besides, it's going to rain. And that way you will have to stay at Netherfield because it's apparent that Mr. Bingley is out for the day. He's not going to be there. So what would be the point in going to Netherfield if she can't see Mr. Bingley? So Mrs. Bennett's whole design is go. It's going to rain hard. Then you'll have to stay. Then you'll inevitably see Mr. Bingley. Make this whole visit worth it. And I think that Jane is just completely mortified, but she does what her mother asks. And they kind of find out that the other horses weren't available anyway. So it was kind of her option. But the scheme works. It rains horribly. Mrs. Bennett is even like, you know, as she's saying goodbye, she's like, with many cheerful prognostics of a bad day. I hope the weather is bad. I sure hope it is. And then when it does rain, she's just completely delighted. And they receive a message the next morning. So Jane has stayed the night. And the message is from Jane. And she's very, very ill. So the plan worked a little too well. Mr. Bennett is like, well, if Jane dies, at least you'll know it was in the pursuit of what you wanted, you know. And Mrs. Bennett says, people do not die of trifling colds. It's going to be fine. But Lizzie is she's very concerned about Jane. So she's like, I'm going to go over there. And she does. She walks over there. It's about a 3-mile walk. And this is just in our day, it's just like, okay, whatever. In that time period, it was kind of unheard of and almost barbaric, I guess. You know, the fact that she walked 3 miles, jumping over stiles and springing over puddles to go and see her sister and to arrive in this beautiful house with these very refined people in the state that she was in, with her petticoat covered in mud and her boots caked in mud, and she's flushed from the exercise. And well, Darcy's yes, her hair is just all over the place. Bingley admires it. He thinks it's wonderful because he thinks that it shows this just deep love and care for and concern for her sister. And Darcy is like, okay, that's a little not normal, but also she looks gorgeous from the exercise, the brilliancy of her cheeks, and he admires it. He does. But the sisters, of course, they can find no good in Elizabeth, and they just think it's the worst thing that she would walk all this way to come see her sister. It turns out that she ends up staying at Netherfield too. She had no intention of going and staying, but she does. Jane is not doing well and she really doesn't want Lizzie to leave. And so Elizabeth ends up staying, which turns out to be kind of an education for Lizzie. Something that becomes immediately apparent. Lizzie never really did like Mrs. Hurst and Miss Bingley, but she does see how very two-faced they are. Like when they're immediately paying attention to Jane, they're very like attentive and kind and everything. But then as soon as they're out of the room, they're just like very cold, they're shallow, they're unkind, and they couldn't care 2 cents about really anybody but themselves. I put myself in her shoes and I think I would be so uncomfortable. And I think that she was, but Mr. Bingley is such a wonderful gentleman. And so he's kind of the reason that she felt like she could keep staying because he made her feel more than welcome. So whenever Lizzie is out of the room, Miss Bingley and Mrs. Hurst sort of take that opportunity to just rip into her and degrade her, especially when Mr. Darcy is there. Like you said, Nan, it's very apparent that Miss Bingley is like trying to put her claws in Mr. Darcy, and she wants him so badly that she's desperate. She's like, oh my gosh, he kind of has a thing for Elizabeth, so I'm going to do everything I can to tear her down and make her seem less than worthy. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. Like everything that she says, both Mr. Bingley and Mr. Darcy are like defending her. Mr. Bingley is just like, no, she's wonderful. She's, you know, this and this. And Mr. Darcy, he's very practical. He's very realistic. You know, he'll say things like, yeah, I wouldn't want my sister to do what she did. And that was kind of crazy, but also the exercise made her cheeks more red and brilliant, you know. Anyway, so in the evening, Lizzie joins them in the drawing room. They're like playing a game. She doesn't want to join in. So she goes and grabs a book. And that sort of sets off this whole train of conversation. They're talking about the importance of books and the importance of having a library. And I love this line that Mr. Darcy says, which I feel like should apply in every day and age. He says, I cannot comprehend the neglect of a family library in such days as these. And I think that every day is such days as these because every family needs a library. They go on to talk about Pemberley, which is Darcy's estate, which I don't think has really been mentioned up to this point, but it's just this grand estate that like Miss Bingley wants Charles to build something to have a house like Pemberley. Well, really, she wants Pemberley. It's just incredible. Then they start talking about Miss Darcy, who's Mr. Darcy's younger sister. And then this leads into talking about accomplished women. This, I think, could be a very It was quite a controversial conversation. So Mr. Bingley is like, how are all the ladies just so accomplished? She's like, whenever I hear or I'm introduced to a young lady, I hear about all of her accomplishments. And I just am so amazed at their patience in learning these things. And Miss Bingley is much more critical. And so is Darcy. Mr. Darcy says, the word is applied to many a woman who deserves it no otherwise than by netting a purse or covering a screen. He says, I cannot boast of knowing more than half a dozen in the whole range of my acquaintance that are really accomplished. So Miss Bingley sort of like backs him up. And I love how Jane Austen is like, Miss Bingley is his faithful assistant. Whatever Darcy says, she's going to agree with and like add to and support his argument. So she says, a woman is only accomplished if she has a thorough knowledge of music, singing, drawing, dancing, and the modern languages. And besides all this, she must possess a certain something in her air and manner of walking, the tone of her voice, her address and expressions, or the word will be but half deserved. And then Darcy says, and to all of that, she needs to add something more substantial in the improvement of her mind by extensive reading. And I think in a way he was like, kind of trying to say, look, Lizzie, you're a reader. You're awesome. But Lizzie's response is just like, bam. She says, I'm no longer surprised that you're knowing only six accomplished women. I rather wonder now at your knowing any. What are you talking about? What woman does all of those things well? And she's like, I've never seen any woman who does all those things. She says, I never saw such capacity and taste and application and elegance as you describe. It's almost not possible. Lizzie leaves the room and Miss Bingley like rips into her for that. She's like, she's one of those young ladies who seeks to recommend herself by undervaluing her own sex.
Exactly what she's doing as soon as Lizzie leaves the room.
It's exactly what she's doing. Totally. And I love Darcy's response here because he says, whatever bears affinity to cunning is despicable. That's sort of his slam towards Miss Bingley. He's like, but look what you're doing. You know, everything that you're doing is quite despicable because you're trying to bring her down to try to elevate yourself. Yeah, there's a lot there. Sorry, guys. Chapter 7 and 8. I just loved him. And so there's a lot.
I think unpacking that conversation about accomplishment, I think it's one of the most brilliant drawing room conversations ever. There's so many things going on like multiple levels. It is almost like Darcy and Elizabeth are having this flirtation conversation that's taking place.
Oh, totally.
Third party. And we see this over and over again while they're at the house, is that Miss Bingley oftentimes is not really part of the conversation. Even when she thinks she is, they're almost using her as a cover to be able to converse through. And to Mr. Darcy's, the other part of that line, there is meanness in all the arts, which ladies sometimes condescend to employ for captivation. Yeah. And in this case, meanness, it is just to be mean, but it also means like a littleness. He is really saying to Caroline here, you're not a shining example of any kind of character that I'm talking about either. And if she was paying at all attention, if she understood anything he was saying, she would know that she's in trouble there. But yeah, she doesn't. She keeps doubling down on this. The other thing I've been kind of looking for as I've been reading through this time is that, you know, when you read the best books and you read them over and over again, you have to kind of find fresh insights or ways to look at them so they don't seem redundant. So one of the things I'm looking for is kind of the romance novel tropes that Austen sort of like founded almost that show up all over again. So the two that have come up so far is this, they start as enemies trope. That was new in Austen's time. They were either like villains or good guys. There wasn't this like we change in between, right? But then this section here is this proximity trope, mm-hmm, where to the extent they're able to under this strict society, she basically now is his roommate for a week here and lives under the same roof as him. And so they get a chance to be in proximity to one another. And you can tell at times this really annoys Elizabeth, where she'll just like get up and leave like she did in this situation. And the other thing we have to realize about Elizabeth here is as clever as she is, they always describe her as being arch, this kind of like she replied archly, like it's this sort of tone where she's witty and clever, but kind of sardonic. She sees the absurd. She kind of has her dad's sense of humor, but she also is very much out of her depth for this kind of thing. The Bingley sisters have moved in the first fashion circles in London, and Elizabeth knows on some level, like she can't compete with that. So she's trying to be herself. She's doing admirably. She's coming back with these witty comebacks. She's really holding her own, but she is such a novice at this game that Caroline is playing, that Caroline is probably pretty well practiced at, has probably been out in London for a few seasons now. So sometimes I think she just has to walk away from it because this is a game. Again, she's doing really, really well, but she's out of her depth for the game that's being played.
And that's when she kind of has to fall back on just being herself. And she is, she's very intelligent. She's witty. She's clever.
She's forthright. She's honest.
Yeah. She's wonderful. It's just, she's not practiced in those kind of scheming games that these others are. And oh, well, you know, and it does make me wonder too, where the Bingley sisters, they have been out in London society, but they don't have a title. Does it make you wonder if they're also sort of like the lower rungs of the London society? So they come out to the country and they're like, oh, look, we're the big dogs in town now. So now we get to treat everybody else the way that we sometimes get treated because we're not nobility at all.
That's an excellent point. I think they're playing it up for their audience when they get out to the country.
Yeah, but I did also think about this idea of accomplished women, and I'm like, thorough knowledge of music, singing, drawing, dancing, the modern languages, and all these other things, the air and manner of walking, the tone of her voice. And I just think, well, today, at least we can take care of ourselves. We can get ourselves dressed. We can cook our own meals and we can clean our own houses and we take care of our children. We can get a job and we can sustain ourselves. So just our idea of being accomplished, all of those other things are so wonderful and valuable and important, but just our idea of accomplished is, I think, different today. What do you guys think? Like, what is your idea of an accomplished woman?
Well, I think that we can define our own definition of what accomplished is, right? And I think sometimes we have this idea of what accomplished is that we'll never hit. Okay, I can't draw. I can't, you know, there's certain things I'm not that great at, right? My house isn't perfectly clean or whatever. And so we look at those things that we're not good at and think, if I had that, then I'd be accomplished. Then I'd be okay. I think we need to like say, okay, I work, I earn money, I cook for my family, I look at all the things I can do and just be okay with it and be like.
So at our last, we had a stake relief study activity, and the idea behind that was to have people come and sort of talk about goals they'd been setting for themselves and just different things. And then we had different women at different tables, like kind of conducting conversations around goals or different things. And as I was talking to sisters who were going to like do the different tables, I was amazed at all the things. Like Like our friend Carol, she brought all this like crochet. She's part of a crochet club. And once a month they like send a pattern. And then she puts another 6 or 8 inches on this afghan that she's making. And it's beautiful. And like every 6 inches, it's a totally different print and pattern.
That's cool.
And then another sister came and she's like, oh yeah, I got into beekeeping this year. I'm like, that's cool. Right. Yeah. And just all these different things that these women were doing, that there's no way in a lifetime you could ever say, yes, I'm going to do all of these things. But I think it's such a celebration in modern times of like women, like saying, yeah, I can't have it all. And that's okay. Like, what do I want? And then like going forth and like doing that thing. And so you do have women in general who are accomplished in all their many and different ways. You know, that's a thing to be celebrated versus this idea that there was one cookie cutter mold they could get poured into, because the Bingley sisters have tried so hard to pour themselves into this mold. And what's ended up is that Mrs. Hurst, the oldest Mrs. Bingley, is married to a totally lame husband. And she's idle and bored, and all she has to do is gossip, and she can play the piano well, but that's about it. And she's vapid, and her sister is the same. And her sister's value lays in mostly like, can I keep house for my brother or can I secure a rich man? That's all they care about. And yeah, it's a very solipsistic, a very selfish kind of like inward looking. I mean, to me, I would say if there's one thing that you have to add to any accomplished woman is, what does she do for other people? Yeah. None of this is stuff that you would do for other people.
Yeah, it doesn't actually end up contributing anything. I mean, yes, it, when people can play and sing and all, it does contribute some beauty and art because we need that. We need that. But it's certainly not like an outward idea or approach. It's not others oriented at all.
And in the meantime, you've got, you know, London at the time is one of the biggest cities in the world, and you've got people going hungry and starving, and there's like real want and need. You know, Dickens is a little bit later, but we read the flip side of this culture in Dickens. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you realize just how much suffering was taking place that then genteel of England were glossing over. And when you look at like somebody with, you know, different numbers have been thrown around, but you look at some of these fortunes and the kind of land they own, these are modern day billionaires. Right. And some of them were doing philanthropic work and many of them were not. And they didn't care. And they felt like it was their divine right because of where they had been born. Their divine right to reject people in poverty. Yeah. Which is a complete antithesis of what we understand true Christianity to be. And these people would have all been like steeped in Christianity.
Yeah.
There's actually a novel that was written called Longbourn that's kind of an upstairs, downstairs look at Pride and Prejudice. And it's told from the viewpoint of Mrs. Hill, who's mm-hmm. their housekeeper, and the couple of people that she has working for them in the Bennet household.
That's kind of fun.
It is fun. It's a little bit edgier. It kind of shows this sure. like underbelly of like what this culture really looked like, but it's quite well written and it's told from the viewpoint of a little housemaid that lives in, you know, talking about all the laundry she has to do when all these girls get their period at the same time.
Yes.
How it was like a huge part of her weekly tasks was to do these mountains and mountains of laundry so the girls could always have clean dresses and clean clothes.
I think it's always so fascinating to hear about all the aspects of something. I think that we do. I think we tend to look back on the finest points of history and not the dirty, ugly points.
It's all important.
I love hearing about all of it because we have to get a whole picture for us to be able to actually learn from it. Yeah. What do we learn if we only get half a picture? So
anyway, that was a big digression.
No, I think it was
accomplished awesome. Woman, but what a great question. What does it mean to be an accomplished woman? I love it.
Yeah.
And I love your definition. I think that's perfect. Look outside of you. What are you doing for those around you rather than what you're doing for yourself to make yourself look good or like
and it? That can really include all the things you do for your family. Cause I think that's another thing. I mean, not all your listeners are going to be moms, but we're going to be, you know, aunts or daughters, or we're going to be parts of families in some ways. And I think of all those mundane tasks while your kids are growing up that you do for your kids. Like nobody is like feeding the hungry or clothing the naked better than a young mom. And I think we overlook that too often to say, oh my gosh, I'm not doing enough for other people. It's like, are you kidding me? 99% of your time is spent in service to other people. If you're in a phase in your life where I can't even get a shower to get away from my responsibilities to my family, I promise you're enough.
Absolutely. I've shared this story a couple of times. I don't know if I've shared it with you guys, but years ago when we lived in Portland, we had the sister missionaries come over, and I loved the sister missionaries. This one particular time, though, this young sister, she was very exuberant and enthusiastic. And, you know, we had just moved there, and I was so overwhelmed with, I had my four little kids, this new area where I didn't know anyone. I'm 1,000 miles from family. And the ward was wonderful, but still, you just don't know anybody. And I just started homeschooling because I felt like it was the best thing to do. And it just, everything was really overwhelming. And the sister, you know, we had her over for dinner, and she kept saying, okay, well, I want you to commit. Who are you going to talk to this week and invite to church? Who are you going to invite to church? Who are you going to invite to an activity? Who is it going to be? And she's like, I want you to commit and name them. And I was like, the overwhelming feeling was just my children. You know, we talk about the worth of souls and like gathering them, and my children's souls are just as important as anybody else out there. And these are the ones that I'm assisting and helping right now. So I'll give you their names, because that's who I'm taking to church right now. And so,
amen. In chapters 9 and 10, Elizabeth continues to stay at Netherfield Hall with her sister, but her mom makes a visit. And when her mom visits, she brings two of the younger sisters with her. Most of the Bennett women are now under the roof at Netherfield. And it's during this visit, I think for the first time, that we see all of our principal characters kind of in the room at the same time without the distraction of other people or a ball or something to do other than visit. And it's during this visit in chapter 9 that you clearly see how out of her depth Mrs. Bennett is with these people, and how unself-aware she is for how out of her depth she is. Elizabeth is very self-aware, and she's quite embarrassed by it. She is working very hard during this conversation to protect her mother and her sisters from their meanness, while at the same time trying to smooth over her mother's rudeness. So Lizzie is able to walk this line between these two groups, because on the one hand, she can see how cleverly insulting the Bingley sisters and Mr. Darcy are being to her mom. Although Darcy holds it together pretty well here, he just doesn't say much. Mr. Bingley is very nice, but the Bingley sisters are horrible. Mm-hmm. But then her mother is also horrible. And so Elizabeth's having to walk this line between these two. And you can see that as embarrassed as she is by them, she really does care about her mom and sisters, and also doesn't want them to be offended. So she's kind of navigating that. And it's just this really, again, this clever way that Elizabeth has of being in society. And then in chapter 10, we get more of this nighttime repartee between Elizabeth and everybody else that she's in the house with. We see this growing attraction that Mr. Darcy has for her. So just a couple of quick things then from chapter 9. First of all, Lizzie acts with a little bit of familiarity towards Mr. Bingley because she's been in the house for a few days. Lizzie, cried her mother, remember where you are and don't run on in the wild manner you've suffered to at home. So she calls Lizzie out on this kind of bantering that she's doing on her behavior right away. And then she proceeds to just really be super embarrassing. She talks about the country being better. She basically insults Mr. Darcy to his face. It says one time Elizabeth, who again is always able to be herself and is quite confident, it says at one point she blushes for her mother because of what she says. She almost comes to Mr. Darcy's defense over something he said a little bit while she's trying to smooth this out. And nothing but concern for Elizabeth could enable Bingley to keep his countenance. So even Bingley is affected by something her mother has said here, but he is so nice. His sister was less delicate and directed her eyes towards Mr. Darcy with a very expressive smile. Like, look who your mother-in-law would be. And just this horrible, awkward situation. Elizabeth makes the other pronouncement here that's hilarious, where it's clear that Jane, at least once in the past, had a suitor who sent her some pretty bad poetry. And so ended his affection, Elizabeth said impatiently. There's been many a one I fancy overcome the same way. I wonder who first discovered the efficacy of poetry in driving away love. And Darcy, well, I had been used to consider poetry as the food of love. Oh, of a fine, stout, healthy love, it might. Everything nourishes what is strong already. But if it's only a slight, thin sort of inclination, I'm convinced that one good sonnet will starve it away entirely. And then Darcy sort of like smiles to that, but it's almost like it's too absurd for anybody else to get the joke. And maybe yeah. Darcy could have if he was like, it was just the two of them. but it's not really a polite company sort of statement. Then
because there's a long silence afterwards.
Yes, super awkward. Elizabeth does not appeal it. And then the other thing is the younger sisters have been kind of whispering throughout the conversation, which is extremely rude. And then they basically invite themselves to Netherfield and they tell Mr. Bingley basically he needs to throw them a ball. And Bingley agrees to it. So that's a big thing you have to look forward to. So in Austin, that's another big thing. This is another, this kind of fairy tale trope that comes up is that in these romance novels, there's always some big event to look forward to, like a ball or a dance or a party or something. And so now we have the Netherfield ball kind of looming on the horizon to look forward to. In chapter 10, you get this idea of letters coming up in Austin. And Mr. Darcy is sitting at a writing table and writing letters. And Caroline, in an attempt to distract him from his letter writing, keeps commenting on the letters, and she's totally annoying. And you realize Darcy's writing to his sister, so she's going to be a character that shows up later. Her name has been mentioned a couple of times. Darcy's father will find out eventually. Darcy's father has passed away, and so Darcy is basically his sister Georgiana's, she's his ward. He's her guardian. And so he's quite concerned about her. And so Miss Bingley is commenting on the writing again to try to juxtapose herself to Elizabeth, like, hey, I'm already on intimate terms with your sister. Tell her how much I'm looking forward to seeing her again, you know, leaving Elizabeth out of that conversation. Again, they sort of have this like really charming kind of conversation that takes place through Miss Bingley, who keeps trying to insert herself in the conversation, but can't. And is not even sure of what's going on. And I just underlined pages and pages here in chapter 10. She kind of puts words in Darcy's mouth. From their very first conversation, she's assumed she knows how Darcy feels about her. So now she's constantly putting words into his mouth. Miss Bingley starts playing the piano. And Mr. Darcy says to Elizabeth, do you feel a great inclination, Miss Bennet, to seize the opportunity of dancing a reel? And the way he asks the question is he's kind of given himself a way out if she tells him no. But she assumes that he doesn't want to dance with her because he said so from the beginning. Oh, I heard you before. I didn't immediately determine what to say in reply. You wanted me to say, I know, and to say yes. So you'd have the pleasure of despising my taste. But I always delight in overthrowing these kind of schemes. And she kind of goes on for a moment. And she says, now, despise me if you dare. And he says, indeed, I do not dare. And Elizabeth, having rather expected to affront him or offend him, was amazed at his gallantry, but there was such a mixture of sweetness and archness in her manner, which made it difficult for her to affront anybody. And Darcy had never been so bewitched by any woman as he was by her. He really believed that were it not for the inferiority of her connections, he would be in some danger. And it's just everything about her. He's just completely enchanted by her, but it's horrifying to him that he would be, because we just saw the conversation with the mother, and he's not unaware of all the things Mrs. Bingley's saying. He knows right. that Miss Bennet anywhere near his sphere would be unsupportable. And yet he can't help but fall in love a little bit more every time he's around her.
He wants to love her, but he can't because of her, where she comes from, her social status.
Social status barriers. Yes.
Yeah. Here we go. I was thinking about like any Cinderella type.
Yeah.
Novel, you know, or story. It's just like, he wants to love her, but he just can't because of who she... Have you guys seen that movie? It was a Christmas movie on Netflix where this like Asian boy, he pretends to be like, he shows her a picture of who he is, but that's not really who he is. And he like...
Oh, so, like catfishing?
There you go. He catfished.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm like, there's a word. What is it? And they fall in love talking about all these things that are, you know, important and interesting or whatever. And then so she flies out to like see him. And when she finds out who he actually is, he's this like dorky little smart guy that isn't somebody that she would normally date. And so now she's like, well, I can't be with you because you're not, you know what I mean? Just kind of the same thing. It's a great movie. It's, I mean, it's not terribly appropriate, but it was really cute. I loved it. In chapters 11 and 12. Now I do struggle with the conversations a little bit. Just FYI. Like, I think they're kind of hard to follow.
This is where good movies can come in really handy, because you see which characters are saying which, and you see that like quick exchange between the characters a little better.
Yeah. That's also what's hard, is it's very hard to figure out who's talking because she doesn't say.
Not always.
I mean, occasionally, but not all the time. So
because she doesn't want to interrupt the back and forth.
Okay, so Jane is finally feeling better and she's able to join everybody in their like evening activities. So this is the first night that she's out again. And Mr. Bingley is really only paying attention to her and talking to nobody else. Caroline is watching Mr. Darcy read while she's also pretending to read herself. I love in books like this where like reading is considered this like great characteristic, you know? So you've got him who's actually reading and then she's pretending to read. And so she's getting bored. And I love this too. So she asks Elizabeth to walk around the room with her. And well, she starts walking by herself and it's not getting Darcy's. No, he's not looking at her. And so she's like, oh, I'm going to ask Elizabeth to join me. And so as soon as Elizabeth joins her and walking around the room, then he starts paying attention. And then they invite, well, then Caroline invites him to join them. And he says he doesn't want to interfere. And so he's like, this is why. Either one, you're talking secretively, like you're gossiping. So I don't want to interrupt that. The other option is you're showing off, showing your figures off. And in that case, I'm going to go sit over by the fireplace because I have a better view over there. There's sexual tension in these books, but this is where, this is the line. This is like how far it goes in these like comments, but.
Well, I think that was part of the reason that Keira Knightley version became so popular. It is very well cast. The chemistry between Keira Knightley and the actor who plays Mr. Darcy in that version.
Matthew McFadden.
Palpable. Like it's very, there's just like attraction there from the very beginning. I think that's part of the reason people like that version. But I think Jennifer Eale and Colin Firth have the same. For all that they can't do anything about it other than like longing looks. Heaving bosoms, like
I know, seriously,
that style of dress is all heaving bosom.
It totally is. I think that is the there it is.
Yeah, I just love it. He's like, I'm gonna go sit over by the fireplace so I can see better. And so she says that the best response is for them to just laugh at his ridiculousness, which leads them to discuss what is actually ridiculous about him. So he claims that his main fault is that his good opinion, once lost, is lost forever. And Elizabeth claims that his defect is actually his propensity to hate everybody.
She's like, it's actually much simpler than that. You just hate everybody.
Yes.
And his response to her, I love though.
Yeah, his response is, well, your problem is that you willfully misunderstand everybody. In other words, you don't get me.
Yeah.
And this idea of a good opinion once lost is lost forever. Elizabeth, she points to that as a weakness in Mr. Darcy, but has she not done exactly the same thing? He made a very bad first impression on her. And since then, he's been better. And she is not giving him an inch to be better.
All of these characters are doing exactly what they're accusing other people of doing. Then Elizabeth and Jane write to Mrs. Bennet to send their carriage to take them home. And of course, she says it's unavailable because she wants them to stay there. And so they end up borrowing Bingley's carriage, which is funny because what Mrs. Bennet is trying to do actually backfires because now this makes them look like beggars. Like they don't have the means to come get their own daughters. And so they end up borrowing his carriage and they go home. Mr. Darcy is relieved that they are coming home because he's worried that it's beginning to show that he has affection for Elizabeth. And so for the rest of their visit, he's kind of standoffish. He distances himself from them. And then when they get home, Mrs. Bennet, of course, is upset that they didn't stay. And Mr. Bennet is so excited that they're home because the younger girls, all they can do is talk about the officers and the gossip from them. So he's done with it.
Just underlined where Mr. Darcy says, well, he doesn't say, but it's basically his thoughts. Elizabeth had been at Netherfield long enough. She attracted him more than he liked. And he wisely resolved to be particularly careful that no sign of admiration should now escape him. He's like, danger, 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 you know, all the warning signs going up.
Another thing I read was that conversation, books, walks, these are how they seduced each other. These parties and conversations.
Don't forget letters.
And letters.
Letters are going to be, letters are a huge deal in this time period too.
But, and Caroline has to work to get his attention, but Elizabeth just, it just happens naturally because she's just being who she is.
I think she's really painting this picture that the harder Caroline works, the more he's like, get away from me, you know? So that is not attractive. It's doing the exact opposite because it just comes across as desperation. And I don't think anybody likes that.
Well, and I think there's empathy to be had there too. Caroline is doing exactly what she was raised to do. She thought that if she checked all the lists, had all the accomplishments, had a wealthy brother, had a little bit of a dowry, you know, their society had promised her that somehow she could have like this amazing life if she did it. And in some ways she feels like her sister got it because her sister married a wealthy man, whatever, right? Who can clearly afford to not have to go to work and can spend time with Charles in his mansion for weeks on end, right?
Yeah. Like and not do so, anything. Oh, he just.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so this is, you know, this is what Caroline thought. What her life was going to be, and that she would marry somebody like Mr. Darcy, that she's living her own version of a fairy tale, right? Or thinks she's, or hoping to. I mean, she's awful. She's a really, really awful character, but she is exactly who society has trained her to be. When we, you know, encounter women who are shallow or vapid or whatever, I do think it's sad because I think in some ways, like I look at those women and I think they are becoming exactly who society tells them they should
be. Expects them to be and trains them to be in its own way. Yeah.
Okay, so next week, we'll continue with Pride and Prejudice, chapters 13 through 23. And it should be shorter because it's less chapters.
And we know with three people, there's a lot going on here. So we'll all be more careful.
Except that it's going to be longer episodes. It's fine.
Yeah, it's summer. We got more time.
I know, I do.
Okay, what are you reading, Nan?
Well, I'm reading two books. I'm reading An American Beauty, which is about the first woman in the country kind of to become a millionaire. And it started because she was the mistress of one of the big railroad tycoons. And again, it's about this, like, what will people do when they're really, really desperate? She grew up poor and in the South during the Civil War and was kind of willing to do whatever it took to get her family out of poverty. And so in some ways, I find her kind of a despicable character, but she's also kind of a survivor. And I sort of grudgingly admire what she's willing to sacrifice and give up. Makes me really grateful to live in a time when any woman can achieve anything she wants to just through her own merits and hard work and not by being attached to a man. So An American Beauty. And the other book I'm reading that I really love right now is called Becoming Mrs. Lewis. It's by Patty Callahan. Yeah. Have you guys both read it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wonderful and delightful. And yeah, it's kind of harkens back to this, you know, there's not going to be letter writing anymore for romances to build or grow or friendships. And there's something kind of like lovely and sweet about it. This idea that this like housewife from New York, although that's very reductive for who she really was, she's brilliant. But this housewife from New York could write a letter to C.S. Lewis and he could decide to respond. And then it's years and years of friendship and eventually a marriage. And I just think Patty Callahan's a really, really good writer. And the Christianity pieces that and philosophy that's coming through in it, I kind of adore. I just think she's an amazing character and a great writer. So I'm enjoying that.
Yeah, that's the book that inspired her to write Once Upon a Wardrobe.
Which I adored. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, I loved Becoming Mrs. Lewis. That was wonderful.
Have you read Once Upon a Wardrobe, Amity?
I have not read that one yet. No.
That you'll love that one too.
I will have to put it on my TBR. I've got so many. There's so many good ones.
I had five on my Goodreads for about every one I read, I think. I don't know.
I know. Seriously. Can't read or listen fast enough.
I know, right?
First of all, I want to say I just finished The Rose Code. I did talk about it last week in the episode that you and I did, Laura. But so it's The Rose Code by Kate Quinn. And it was long. It took me longer than normal to get through it just because summer is crazy. So I just haven't had as much opportunity. But I loved it so much. It was just wonderful. And especially the fact that she based all of her characters on real people. And so And I think when I talked about it before, I wasn't like super far into it, but it is the story of Bletchley Park in England and just all of the code breaking that was happening during World War II and how that really at least shortened the war, if not helping to like end it and therefore saving
lives. And invented the computer.
Yeah, like so much technology came from Bletchley Park. Like just, it was just this gathering of just the most brilliant minds and sort of eccentric characters, but you find you've got to have that in order to think laterally. It was interesting because Kate Middleton's grandmother was one of the workers at Bletchley Park. And so she sort of has this cameo in it. And Ian Fleming worked at Bletchley Park, and all these like really just brilliant people. And none of them were like main characters in a book, but one of the main characters was actually based very heavily on Ozla Benning, who was like the longtime war girlfriend of Prince Philip. And she named her Ozla Kendall so that it wouldn't be like exactly, and she wouldn't have to like stay true exactly to the character of Ozla Benning, but just loved her. She was just wonderful. Anyway, I finished that. I loved it.
Did you read The Rose Called Laura? I thought we had talked about that once. It's kind of one of those found family kind of books in a lot of ways too. Women who find each other during the war and really become each, they're like sisters almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was of the year that I read The Rose Code, it was one of my favorites of the whole year. It's one I'm actually recommending to people too.
Oh, absolutely. And then the brilliance in writing it, I was like, she had to do so much research to be able to write credibly and intelligently about all this code breaking stuff. Like it was.
You should add The Diamond Eye to your list also if you like Kate Quinn. The Diamond Eye was one I finished by her 8 months ago. That's about a Russian female sniper during the Second World War who was a real person who eventually met Eleanor Roosevelt. Wow. And it's so good. Brilliant. Yeah.
Okay. That will also be on my to be read. But so the book that I'm reading right now that is, I was like, I'm going to pick up a physical book, not just listen. It's Own Your Past, Change Your Future by Dr. John Delaney. And I've listened to him a lot. I really like him a lot. But so basically, it's just about how the stories we tell ourselves affect everything. And so here's just sort of like a brief overview. It just says, we're all carrying the weight of our trauma based on the stories we were told by others and the ones we tell ourselves. And those stories are like bricks in a backpack that keep us from being happy and healthy. So Dr. John Delaney provides a clear 5-step path to being well, just like redefining your trauma, how to identify it in your life, grieve and heal from past hurt and trauma, make friends as an adult. And he talks about how important that is to have your people. And he talks about that a lot, just listening to him on his podcast, and changing your thoughts and assessing and evaluating your actions. Anyway, so it's something that I'm not super far into, but I am very familiar with like everything that he says, and it just goes right along with this book. So yeah, it's good.
I just watched The Minimal Mom. She interviewed him on her podcast. I actually saw it on YouTube. She puts her podcast on YouTube, and he was talking about this book and how important it is for adults to have relationships, especially men, because they don't tend to.
Yeah.
And so anyways, I thought it was interesting. You should look that up after you read it.
Yeah, I will. Yeah.
I love The Minimal Mom. She's amazing.
Yeah. But I do love that sort of push to be like, no, you do need friends as an adult. And I feel that. I know that's true. I testify that's true. Like you need to have people that you can talk to that are in your corner, your ride or die. Like Brené Brown says, you need those people in your life.
So I'm kind of in between books. So I'm still reading What the Wind Knows because I'm like the slowest physical book reader ever. I like Kirsten, I gave her that book and she read like 150 pages while we were sitting there. And I was like, I've been reading this book for weeks and I'm not that far. So anyways, so I'm working on that. I just finished The Postcard. And I'm starting Remarkably Bright Creatures tomorrow.
Oh,
so
fun.
Anyways, so I want to share an old book, and mostly because for some reason, Presley got into my bookshelves and like took this whole series out. And I was like, what are you doing with my books? I'm like, we went to the beach on Friday and she took one of these. And I was like, are you going to read that? I don't know. Anyways, it's called Love Comes Softly by Janet Oak. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I was like 15, my grandma loaned me these books. And so they mean a lot to me. I know they're kind of simple, but there's a whole series and they're just delightful. And like, she's a Christian writer. So there's a lot of like Bible verses and principles in it. But it's the story of this young woman who is crossing the plains with her husband. They've just been married, but she's expecting. And they're stopped kind of close to, I think, where they're going to land. And he goes off for the day to hunt or something, and he dies. And so she's waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for him in the wagon. And these people come by and say they've found him. And so she's stuck, totally not to where she was going. She can't go back because it's going to be winter. She's expecting. And so she, you know, against her wishes, she ends up marrying this man who has I think the movie portrays her as older, but in the book, I believe she's about 4 years old. And so she just becomes an instant mom, but doesn't love her husband. But through the whole series, you know, eventually she decides that she loves him and they end up having more children together. And it turns out wonderful. His name's Clark. He's a wonderful man. Like, he gives her the time and space to do what she wants to do. He tells her, like, after the winter, if you want to go back to, you know, back east, you can. Anyways, I just love these books. So
we read the first one for book group a long time ago.
Years ago.
I have a memory of being like at Cherie Borders' house, maybe.
That's, yep. Mm. That's where we met. Probably a little simple for Nan, but.
No, I enjoyed it. Yeah, I think it's good to have a combination of books. You can't read The Rose Code every day.
No. Yeah, this is light and fluff.
Yeah.
And also not, because there's a lot, you know, at least at the beginning, something heavy happens, but I love them. And they remind me of my grandma. She's been gone for a long time. So, okay, 2 hours later, we did it. We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, chapters 13 through 23. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.